copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I'll start by sharing a bit of a story, a bit of my story, actually. When I was about 14, I went to a school in Leicester. I mentioned yesterday Leicester was the first city in Britain to have an ethnic majority. So my school was about 1,000 students, all boys, 11 to 16 years old. I'd grown up in a Christian family. I professed faith when I was about the age of 7 through our Sunday school at church. But then going into this secondary school, surrounded by people of different kind of cultural and religious backgrounds, you suddenly start to ask the question, don't you? You know, am I just a Christian because my parents are Christians? And in the school, there were only three people that I knew of, including myself, that would have called themselves Christian out of 1,000 students. And so in our wisdom, we decided to start a Christian union. And it was obviously quite small. There were three of us. I was the president. My mate was the vice president, and the other guy was the secretary. And we used to meet up and have this Christian Union meeting every week in room 22. And then one week we decided, well, this is rather boring doing a kind of Christian Union for three of us. Let's try and do an event where we can invite other people to come. So we put on an event that we'd heard of called Grill a Christian. Not Gorilla Christian, but Grill a Christian. We advertised it widely all over the school, and we just basically said to everyone, particularly the atheists, come and ask your questions. You can ask whatever you like for an hour. This is the room. This is the day. Now, I was never going to stand up in front and try and answer the questions. I was petrified. But I called up a local friend. He was one of the elders of our church. He was a farmer, also my youth leader at church. I said, well, you can come and answer the questions. And I never forget that day, because he came in. We were in an average-sized classroom. There's probably 60 or 70 people in this classroom. It was mayhem. The teachers had completely deserted the place. There were bananas flying backwards and forwards. There were people smoking out of the back window. It was completely crazy. And I just introduced my friends. I said, this is Tim. He's going to answer your questions now. And then I sat down absolutely petrified, thinking, this is where I'm going to be shown up for being a complete idiot. And I'll never forget that hour, because for a whole hour, he just answered people's questions, you know, one after another after another. No one became a Christian that I know of as a result of that event. But for me, as a young Christian, it was so influential and critical in my own thinking, because it helped me to see that the gospel was a public truth that really stood up to public questioning. And the example of this guy who was able to just very calmly and graciously and succinctly respond to these questions gave me the confidence that although I didn't currently know what the answers were to those questions, that there were answers and that I didn't need to be embarrassed. And so that model of answering questions publicly and showing the gospel as public truth was something, well, really as a 14-year-old, I really learned for myself. And is something that I've continued now to do in various contexts, particularly in university contexts. So I love actually handling questions in a public context. I know not everyone does. And for the guys that we train each year, they normally say the bit that they are most petrified about is the public Q&A. They say, I'm quite happy to give a talk. Quite happy to talk to people one-to-one, but handling a question time publicly in an evangelistic context is scary. And to an extent it is, but it's also incredibly exciting and beneficial. There are a number of pitfalls that we can fall into, and so really what I want to do is help us to see how we can approach that in a more kind of maybe less scary way. Why do a public Q&A firstly? As I said, it shows that the gospel is public truth. A non-Christian will expect us to be able to give a case in 20 minutes for the Christian faith. But can we defend that in the face of their questions? And if we can, it shows that the gospel really is true. It shows that we're not afraid of people's questions or fearful of what they might say. It ensures that we scratch where people itch. In other words, when I'm giving a talk, I'm never sure that what I'm saying is engaging with what people are asking. But when I'm having a Q&A session, I know that what I'm saying is engaging with at least what one person is asking, and potentially far more. It helps us understand where the audience are at in their understanding. I may give what I think is a very eloquent talk, but the questions will reveal what people have actually heard during my speech. A secondary benefit is that it also trains and encourages Christians, just as I, as a 14-year-old Christian, was so encouraged to hear the gospel being articulated and then defended. Again and again, I found Christians have come up in a university context and said, my favourite part of the week has been the Q&A sessions. It's really given me confidence, and I want to be able to now learn so I can be able to do that myself. And if it's done well, I would suggest it's enjoyable for everyone. And there can be a dynamism and an energy to a Q&A which just giving a lecture won't have. And there is interaction and so forth. So it's really, really valuable. But what I want to say is handling questions in a public context is very different to handling it personally. And we talked 2 days ago about how we might do that in conversation. How is it different in public? Firstly, you don't know the background to the question, because the person asking it may be a complete stranger, and you can't know much about their life. You can't stop and have a conversation about their backgrounds. So people are asking questions, and you have to answer them blind, as it were. Secondly, you don't get to ask questions back. So the principle 2 days ago was one of the best things to do in response to people's questions is to ask questions. That's great in conversation. In public, that's particularly more difficult, because if you start asking questions back, you'll have a conversation with one person and everyone else will leave. So you can't really do that. Thirdly, you've got to deal with big questions briefly. If a friend of yours says to you, what does God think about suffering, or why doesn't he stop it? You might have a conversation for an hour about that. You may meet up for longer than that and talk about it. But if you've got a public Q&A, I would suggest that you've probably got about 2 minutes to give some kind of answer to the question. If you spend 5 minutes giving an answer to a question, actually you probably spent too long, because you'll have lost something of the dynamic of the events. So you've got to answer big questions briefly, which means you can't say everything, and you've got to work out, well, what am I going to say? And more importantly, what am I not going to say? And then lastly, it's harder to come back to people when you don't know. So in conversation with a friend, it's okay if you don't know the answer, because you just say to them, I don't know. What's your number? Let's meet up next week and have a coffee. If you're doing it publicly, there's probably not going to be another context in which all these people will be in the same place as you're speaking. And so that's why you wouldn't throw a kind of brand new Christian into handling a public Q&A. We do need to know a bit more. Now, the good thing is there are not an infinite number of questions that people can ask. So it's not that we have to be petrified. And as we'll look later, we can anticipate the questions that people might ask in any given context. But there is a bit more pressure, isn't there, to be able to say at least something in response to people's questions in that context. So it's a very different dynamic that when we're doing it. Now, where might you do this? I've already mentioned one context. You might put on, well, we tend to call it a kind of grill a Christian events or question panel, question time, where the whole purpose is you come in and there's one person or maybe a panel of people at the front and they can ask any questions they like. You might have a moderator to field those questions and so on. That can work. More often, what I do is I will be speaking on a particular topic like we did yesterday, and then at the end we'll have questions. And I generally never speak evangelistically now without having a time for questions at the end. And in a lunchtime talk, I would normally give as much time to the questions as I would to the talk. So you're really giving this a real significant part of what you're doing. I think sometimes this is more helpful, because in our context, we've become so secularized. It's not that people are angry about a Christianity they grew up with and rejecting it. It's just they don't know anything. And so in some senses, when you give a talk, you actually provoke the questions, whereas if you just say any questions, most people say, well, no, I don't have any. So normally you find there are more questions after a 20-minute talk than there would have been if you just went straight to the questions. So even in a question time event, I would normally start off maybe with a 5-minute talk just to get people thinking and to provoke some kind of response. How do you take questions? Obviously, there's different ways you can do this. Firstly, it's really important to advertise this so people know it's coming. So if you're going to do a Q&A at the end of a talk, don't just get to the end of the talk and say, any questions? because people are suddenly thinking, oh, what are my questions? So I always tell people at the beginning, we're going to have time for questions. Really make it clear. Be really positive. Make sure people know that it's okay to ask questions. Don't give the impression that you'll be offended. You know, in Western Europe particularly, there's a lot of talk about creating safe spaces, particularly in universities, because people don't want to feel that they are doing something wrong. And we want to say, you know, this is a safe space where you can disagree, where you can ask your questions, where we won't be offended if you disagree with us. That's absolutely okay. And actually, the Christian community is one of the few remaining real safe spaces left, I think, in our societies, where we are allowing people to disagree, and they can say whatever they like without us being offended. There aren't many organisations where you can do that now, because if you disagree, you're invading their safe space. So it's not really a safe space at all. So advertise it, make sure people know it's coming. How can you take it? Obviously, you can get people to put their hands up. You can get people to write it on paper. I almost always will have a phone number on the screen that people can text. If you put hands up, then the bold, kind of angry atheist will ask his questions, but not necessarily the quiet agnostic who's not sure that they want to speak in front of everyone else. So making sure that people can be anonymous is helpful in a Q&A session. And then what I do is I get the host of the event to read the questions out at the end of the talk. So I'd welcome them back up. They've got the phone or they've got the list of questions. And their job is to collate the questions, to group together questions that are similar. Maybe if there's too many questions, to edit out those that are completely off the topic. And to put them into some kind of order. Now, I've learned this from John Lennox. If you ever watch John Lennox do a public Q&A, he doesn't do it quite like this. But John always leaves the best question till last. The best question is one that gets back to the heart of the topic, gives you an opportunity to say something about the gospel, and then hopefully gives you an opportunity to really get to the heart of the person of Christ. And so as you're looking through the questions, you're saying, what are the questions that might really help do that? And I'm talking to the host, and I'm saying, make sure that's going to be the last question. You don't want to get to the end of Q&A, and the last question is, you know, what about dinosaurs? Which has happened to me on several occasions. And you end up, everyone goes out, you know, thinking, oh, that was a bit, you know. Make sure that it finishes well. And when you're collating the questions, you have some control over that. Obviously, it depends on the questions that come in. But if you brief the host, that can help. Now, if you're doing questions from the floor and questions from the text, that helps because you can interject them between each other. So I might start off with a question from the text, and then I'll say, look, can we go to the floor now? Any questions? Okay, back to the text. And we can go between them in that kind of way. But then if you've got a good question on the text, make sure you finish with a question from the text and so on. So that's how I would take the questions. Important, if you've gotten a lot of time, to keep to it. Much better to finish when people want more rather than people wishing there was a bit less. And actually, if you finish mid-flow, that will only encourage conversations to then spark up around the room. And there's a danger you keep going until the one last atheist has exhausted his final question and everyone else has gone already, and it peters out to a rather mediocre ending. So keep to the time, finish when you say you're going to. How to respond to questions then. Here's a few principles that I've got in mind. Obviously, it's hard to think about all these things at once if you're giving answers. But these are maybe ones that you could jot down and then try and work on as you feel that maybe you need to improve. Firstly, be calm and gracious. Sometimes you get kind of the angry atheist who wants to have an argument. And our calmness and graciousness in response can actually communicate something quite powerful in this context. So even if other people get kind of emotional, breathe, smile, be appreciative and so on in that way. Secondly, be appreciative of people's questions. When someone asks a good question, say thank you, that's a good question. Or that's an interesting point or whatever. Two benefits of that. One, it tells people that it's okay to ask questions. It helps and encourages others to do the same. Secondly, it gives you about 10 seconds to think of the answer. So rather than rushing straight in, having one line or something you can say just to kind of give you time to be thinking and praying and saying, what am I going to do, is helpful. And thirdly, Be understanding. Feel the weight of the question. A bit like yesterday in the talk, I said what you want to do is identify with people. And if you can show that you understand why they might be asking that question, or why they feel that that is a valid objection, so much the better. Yesterday we had the question, what about people that haven't heard? I don't know if you noticed, but what I did deliberately is I didn't start by answering the question. I started by making the question harder, by saying, yes, that's a good question, and what about people in the Old Testament, and what about people that lack the mental capacity, and doesn't that seem unfair? So what I'm trying to do is get on their side and help them see that I appreciate where they're coming from. And that will really help them to then listen to what I might say in response. Be humorous. Now, obviously there's an appropriate way to use humour, and I'm not saying that you have to joke all the time. And sometimes, you know, there's a gravity and a seriousness to what we're saying. But sometimes if there is a bit of lightness that we can bring into a Q&A that lifts the kind of atmosphere, it can help. What we don't want is a very kind of heavy atmosphere where it gets more and more serious and people then feel quite awkward. So where appropriate, being able to use some humour, self-deprecating or whatever, is helpful. And what I found, and this is the same when you're giving a talk, when you've just used humour and you've made people laugh, people are actually the most receptive then to a very serious point sometimes afterwards. And you see it's made people relax, and then you can kind of go in with a very serious point too. So we don't want to be glib, but we do want to just make sure that we vary the weight of the kind of event so that people don't feel it becomes too intense. We need to be wise and anticipate people's reactions. You know, if someone says to you, is homosexual practice sin? And you just say, yes. Next question. Well, actually, what are most people in Western society going to think, at least? They're going to be thinking all sorts of things about you now. Bang, bang, there's going to be 100 questions and so on. Now, it's not that you don't answer the question necessarily, certainly not that we don't speak the truth, but what are people going to think if I say this? And how can I get behind people's assumptions? There's a principle, someone said, don't answer big questions with short answers. You know, don't just say yes or no sometimes. We've got to get behind that. Where is it coming from? And so on. So we need real wisdom sometimes in those situations. Be focused on Christ. You know, it's amazing how so many times when the questions that come up, we can get to the gospel, we can get to Jesus. And so be thinking, how can I make a route from this question to Christ, to the gospel? This is a really key one. Be positive. The gospel is good. I was doing a Q&A session once, a number of years ago, when I just started in university work, and a good friend and mentor of mine, in fact, the very guy who had given that Q&A when I was a 14-year-old boy, was sitting in the back of the room, and I said to him at the end, any comments, anything I could improve? He said, technically everything you said was fine. He said, there's nothing wrong with your answers, but try and be more positive. You see, questions often come with a kind of negative assumption about the gospel. And if we can turn that negativity around in a positive way and keep coming back to the gospel is good news, that will really help. So, you know, why would God send people to hell? Yeah, but actually in the gospel we've got a God who offers to everyone the offer of forgiveness and a relationship with him. Yeah, how is there only one way? But isn't it incredible that there is a way and God invites people to him? You know, isn't God anti-sex? God created it and it's good. And if he's got a blueprint for it, it's for our good and for our flourishing and not for our harm and so on. So just be thinking, how can I turn this negative assumption around in a positive way, and how can I leave it with a kind of positive note at the end of the question? Or the answer, sorry. Be prepared. If you're going to give a talk on a particular subject, then you can actually potentially anticipate the kind of questions that people are going to ask. And so you can then prepare what you might say in response to those things. And people do this in all sorts of contexts. I mean, Prime Minister's questions in the British Houses of Parliament. I mean, the Prime Minister is briefed beforehand. These are the kind of questions that are going to come up. They've got a whole pack of notes so that when the questions do come up, they have something to say. And in the same way, if you're going to give a talk on a subject, try and think, what would the top 10 questions be off the back of what I say? And it may be helpful to jot down some thoughts so that when those questions come up, you have got that. And it may be helpful to sit down with some other Christian friends and say, what do you think the questions might be? And that's something I do very much with our associates. Every time they give a talk, we do a kind of mock Q&A session and anticipate what the questions will be beforehand. Be honest. Obviously, it's harder in this context if you don't know the answer. But at the same time, it's not good to just, you know, fob people off with, you know, something if you don't really know what to say. And sometimes you get very specific questions on very specific issues that we just don't know the answers to. And I think it's okay sometimes to say, look, I'm not able to answer that specifically now, but if anyone really wants to look into that, I'll be around at the end, I'll happily come back to you or something. So you give people an opportunity. People don't necessarily expect us to know everything about everything straight away. Or at least if they do, we can be honest and say, look, I don't know everything about everything. We still give them the opportunity to come back to us later on. Be helpful. You can offer further reading, another talk, an online resource, particularly because you're not going to be able to say everything. You know, if you've got 2 minutes to answer the question of suffering, you're not going to be able to say much at all. But that's why we would always have a bookstall or, you know, web addresses or something. You say, look, I haven't said much, but why don't you look at this book? Or why don't you come back on Thursday? We're going to have a talk on this. Or look at the, you know, so on. So you're showing that there's far more on that topic than you've just said. And you're not pretending that your 2 minutes is the exhaustive answer on that particular issue. And then be prayerful as you do it. Obviously, you're not going to have a prayer meeting, close your eyes or put your hands together, but those kind of Nehemiah arrow prayers. You remember when Nehemiah says, I prayed to the God of heaven and I answered the king? So just asking God for help in the moment to give you wisdom to be able to discern how to respond in an appropriate manner to what's just been said. Now, that all may sound fine in theory, but here's the bit that probably we're really worried about. What if? They used to say of Concorde, you know, the plane, Concorde, and the Concorde was always crashing in 1,000 different ways, and the computer systems were there to try and keep it stable. And I think a Q&A is always crashing in 1,000 different ways, and our job as the person at the front is to basically manage that time so that it doesn't fall into one of these potential mistakes or areas, okay? And I've outlined... The good news is I've got about 10, but they don't normally all happen at once. There's normally a potential of one of these happening in any one situation. So what if... Well, I'll show you what they all are first of all, okay? What if there are no questions at all? People sit there, absolute silence. What if people don't ask questions, but they make long statements, and they just want to tell you everything they know? What if you get lots of questions, but they're all from one person on the back row who won't shut up? What if people get really angry and there's too much animation? What if the questions go off topic and you end up on a complete tangent, which was nothing to do with the talk? What if they come obviously from Christians who want to know your particular view on the state of Israel or, you know, God's election or whatever? How do you handle that? What if other people start trying to answer the questions? Now, I had this once. I was doing a Q&A in Kingston University in South London. Half the audience were Muslim. Half the audience were Afro-Caribbean Christian. The Muslims got really animated and wanted to ask all the questions. The Afro-Caribbean Christians were really keen to answer the questions, thought I wasn't doing a very good job, and started shouting across the room, and it was complete mayhem. So what do you do when other people want to start kind of giving answers to the questions because they think you've not done a good job? What about when the questions get stuck on one issue? So you have one question, the next question is off the back of their question, the next question is off the back of their question, and you're stuck on one particular, very narrow question. And what if, finally, you don't understand the question, and you have no idea what they've just asked you? Now, as I said, I've never had a Q&A where all of those things have happened at once. But normally, in every Q&A, there's one of those things that's potentially going to be the problem, okay? But they're not insurmountable. So what we do? Number one, what if there's no questions? It partly depends on the culture. I know in Britain, If I go to a new university, that's a university that kind of came out of what we call the ex-polytechnics, more vocational universities rather than the more academic traditional universities, people will not ask many questions because of the culture and the context. So I can anticipate, before I even go to the university, there'll be lots of questions here. This kind of place, people will be less likely to ask questions. So in those contexts particularly, I really encourage people to do it. I make a big point at the beginning. I say, look, it's fine. I won't be offended. You don't need to be upset. You can ask whatever you like. We make sure that there's anonymity, that's the word I was looking for. Because people won't want to kind of look like they're disagreeing with you in public. I probably would give people a couple of minutes at the end of the talk to discuss with their neighbours what their questions might be. And then the Christians can draw out some of the questions. And then if the non-Christian doesn't want to ask it, the Christian can ask it for them. And if I'm standing at the front and I'm saying, you know, is there any questions? Sometimes I've just got a few things up my sleeve, as it were, that I can ad lib with just to give people time to think. Because sometimes people need a few moments. And so I say, you know, please don't be offended. I won't be offended if you ask questions. I'll be more offended if you don't. I'll assume you haven't listened to anything. And then if there's a big long pause, I might make a joke and say, okay, it's always hard to ask the first question, isn't it? Okay, let's go to the second question. Does anyone want to ask the second question? And yeah, so have a few jokes, a few things. And normally, if you just give it enough time or give people time to discuss, you'll get one. And then normally, if you have one, you'll get others. The hardest question to get in those contexts is the first. What other people are doing is they're watching and they're saying, how does he answer the first question? And if you do a half-decent job and you don't go on for too long, they think to themselves, okay, it's okay to ask questions and I'll ask mine now. So once you've broken the ice and overcome that initial barrier, sometimes after seeming that there's going to be no questions, you'll then have 20 minutes. Of lots of questions. What if there's questions, not questions, but statements? So people just kind of wanting to make a point. I normally try to say, this is a question time, so it's really good if you can have your questions now. If someone's made a statement, it's very hard to answer a statement, isn't it? Because it's not a question. And if you start answering the statement, then it all becomes a bit abstract. So I would get, when they finished, I would just say to them, thank you very much. Can you tell me what your question is? Try and do it with a smile on my face, but you can't answer a statement. If they're making a very, very long and highfalutin statement that's going on for very long, I may just interrupt them and say, sorry to interrupt, but can I just ask you what your particular question is? Sometimes you need to be firm, but if you allow people to start speaking for far too long, then you'll lose the rest of the audience. And you need to be firm with that individual for the sake of the others who are also having to listen to what's going on. So try and draw out what the question is and make sure that that is the case. Number three, what if there are too many questions from one person? And this again can often happen, particularly if you've got the angry atheist who's sitting there who will always want to come back. And if you answer their question and you say, are you happy with that answer? They're never going to say yes, because that would admit to the fact that you might have said something true. So they will always want to come back with something else. Yeah, but what about this? What about this? Now, in that context, I would normally let them come back once, because at least it shows that I'm willing for them to do that. I'm not closing them down. But if I allow them to come back again and again, I'm going to lose the rest of the audience. So I would let them come back once with a follow-up question, and I would answer that. Off the back of that, they'll probably want to ask another follow-up question, and I will just graciously say to them, I'm sure you probably want to ask more off the back of that, but there are other people here, and I want to make sure they have an opportunity to ask too. So let's give them an opportunity first, and we could chat more at the end, if you'd like. So you're not closing them down, you're not giving this impression you're scared of their questions, but you're also giving other people an opportunity in that context, okay? And if they then launch in, because, you know, they're really animated, they won't even wait for you to say, are you happy? They'll just start asking their third question. I sometimes let them ask the third question, and I just say, thanks for the question, but actually I want to give other people an opportunity. So if you want to have an answer to that, come back to me at the end. Because in that, yeah, if you do answer his third question, he'll have a fourth and a fifth and so on. So you just need to be quite firm but gracious. What if people get angry? Again, this sometimes happens. They get very animated. Again, the important thing I would say is that you don't get angry or animated in response. Your graciousness and your calmness can communicate something quite powerful. Remember, you're not just talking to the one individual who's getting angry. You're talking to everyone else as well. Everyone else is watching that individual, and they're also watching you. And they're coming to a conclusion about who they would rather be like. And I've found sometimes in Q&As, I've had, you know, very angry atheists, and I get to the end and I think, oh gosh, I completely failed, because that one individual is still angry. But then I have other non-Christians come up at the end and they say, actually, thank you so much for the way you responded. And actually, I thought he was really obnoxious, but can we talk more? And they were impressed by what they saw. So your graciousness may not convince the angry atheist. They may stay angry, but it may convince the others and be quite powerful in communicating to them. But be warm, be gracious as you can. What if the questions get off topic? It kind of depends how many questions you've got. If you've got the situation at the beginning where hardly anyone is asking questions, then you'll just be glad that someone's asked a question and you'll go with it. If you've got loads and loads of questions coming in, then in that situation, it's appropriate to say, look, that's not really the topic we're looking at today. It might be one that you're doing later in the week. We'll come back to that one another time. So you make the call depending on the context and depending on the number of questions you've got, given the time available. What if questions are obviously from Christians? This often happens. And you're sitting there thinking, well, I've got lots I could say on that subject. But of course, the danger is, if you start having a theological conversation, then the person, you know, the rest of the people in the room who are not Christians may completely switch off. Two things you could do. One is you could just say, that's a particular kind of issue that Christians might want to discuss and debate. I'm aware it's probably not an issue for most people in the room, and therefore if people would like to talk about it, I'd happily chat about it another time, but maybe it's not the most helpful one to deal with now. Okay, so you could just do that. Although I would just highlight, sometimes you do get non-Christians that ask kind of theological questions. So a guy's grown up in a Christian church, they've heard something about the issue of kind of God's sovereignty or Calvinism or something like that, and they're thinking, well, that doesn't sound right. So we've just got to be careful, because sometimes that could be coming from a non-Christian who's got some knowledge of theology and has got some issue to say. So you might want to answer it, but if you answer it, you've got to explain the concepts. The person asking the question may understand what's going on, but you need to say for the other people, okay, you need to understand this is the issue and so on, and try and just bracket it with some context so that you're not losing the audience. Always be thinking of the whole audience, not just the person that's asking the questions. What if other people try and answer the questions? Well, that can happen. And normally what has happened in Kingston, what I had to do was to say, I'm really glad that you've got lots of things to say, and I'm sure you'll all have some very good conversations in about 15 minutes' time when we open up for conversation and discussion. But for now, as it's a Q&A, if you'll give me the honour of being able to answer the questions first, it will help all of us. And again, sometimes you've got to be strong. You know, if we're kind of a little bit timid at this point and we just want to be kind of nice to everyone and say, oh, it's fine, it's great, you'll lose it. And so you've got to be gracious but firm in that. And what if the questions get stuck on one issue? I had this in Cambridge a couple of years ago. I'd given a talk on suffering. The first question was about natural disasters and how that fitted in with the idea of creation and theistic evolution and different things like that. And then, because that was the first question, every question then for the next 20 minutes was all on that particular topic, which was really frustrating, because actually they were very technical, philosophical questions about a particular issue, when the talk had been on a much wider issue and engaged on kind of an emotional issue and everything else. So that's the danger you get kind of that happening. So that's why I particularly find having text questions or written questions helpful, as well as the hands up. Because when you've got hands up, you've got no control over what the next question will be, and people are thinking about what you've just said. Whereas if you've had questions written down or on the text, they're off the back of what you've already said in the talk, not just what you've just said in answer to the first question. So we'll do that question, and then I'll say, okay, let's go to the text. And that will be on a completely different issue. And then you go back to the floor, and that might be on a different... And that way you keep moving around. And again, it keeps the interest level up, because there'll be a lot of people in your audience that won't be interested in that particular question. If you get stuck on that one, you'll lose them. So alternating between questions from the floor and from the text can be a very good way out of getting stuck in one particular ditch or trench. And then lastly, what if you don't understand the question? I realise sometimes, I got to the end of a Q&A and I thought I did a really rubbish job of answering that question. And then I thought to myself, the reason why was I didn't know what I was trying to answer. Now, if someone's asked it from the floor, sometimes what I will do is I'll try and repeat the question back. For the benefit of people who haven't necessarily heard, but also to try and make sure that I've understood it, particularly if I'm not sure I've understood it. So I will say, I think this is what you're asking, is that correct? Okay. Now, if it's on a piece of paper or a text, that's harder to do. But what you could do is you could say, I think what the question is getting at is this. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but that's what I'm going to try and answer. Okay. Now, people might come back and say, no, that's not what I'm saying. And then you say, well, what are you asking? Okay. But it's really important to get kind of clarity and understanding on what the question is before you answer it. Otherwise, you know, I have no idea how to go with it after that. Now, as I say, that might sound scary, but they're not all going to happen at the same time. And if you're aware of what can go wrong, actually, you can hopefully anticipate those things and stop that from happening. As I said, I actually really love doing Q&As. We do it not just in the university context, but when I do like the big questions that we talked about at our church, we always have half an hour for questions at the end of the church service. It's the kind of thing you can do after a sermon at church. It allows for that kind of interaction and so on. I think it's really helpful. It also means that we have to be more sharp. Because if the extent of your knowledge is what you've said in the talk, you've got nothing left to say in the Q&A. And that's the scary thing as a preacher sometimes, because we basically said everything we know on the issue. So it forces us to know more than we say initially on that topic. So we've got to do some more homework to make sure we've actually got something to say on those issues. But it can be really helpful. We've got 10 minutes, so any questions off the back of that? This is where we can anticipate. Yes, we've got an angry atheist over in the... No, sorry. Yeah, so what if you're working for a translator? I do a lot of talks through translation, particularly in Eastern Europe. And it can get a bit harder, obviously, if you're doing it. And what I'm trying to do is just be really succinct. And so what would I normally say? Okay, how can I strip that down even more simply? But also, when I'm working through translation, I find humour is quite important to get some kind of connection. If I'm giving long and complicated answers, I can see in people's eyes, they're glazing over. So I'm trying to bring some kind of humour or lightness to get some kind of connection. And particularly if you're speaking through translation, if you can get people to smile at least, or you know, even if they don't laugh at something you've said, you've suddenly got connection with your audience, and it's not so much kind of this complicated route through the translator. The other thing that's worth saying is if your host is having to read questions and translate questions at the same time, that's going to be too much. And so I have a second person who is actually collating the questions, translating them, and then passing them to the host, because it's too complicated. And especially if they're then translating you, they can't translate you and read a phone and translate the questions all at the same time. And then you end up with long pauses where you're trying to struggle with what's going on. Yeah. Yeah, so what would I do if the question from the audience is on an issue, maybe a kind of a secondary issue or an issue where you know a lot of people in the audience have a particular issue and you would have a different one, maybe contraception or maybe drinking alcohol. You know, I've had people ask in context, you know, should Christians drink alcohol? I know that all the Christians in the room don't drink alcohol, and I'm thinking, what do I say in that situation? I think I want to be faithful to what the Bible says, but I also want to be sensitive to the culture. So I can't say at the front of the room, it is unchristian to drink alcohol. Because I just don't want to make the point that the Bible says you cannot. At the same time, I want to be sensitive to the culture, where there will be a lot of Christians who, for various cultural reasons, will say, actually, it's wrong in our culture or unhelpful in our culture to drink alcohol. So I don't want to then undermine them. So I want to say, this is what the Bible says. In this cultural context, maybe this is how Christians, you know, operate. Not all Christians will hold that opinion, and I'm trying to kind of hold that kind of middle line. Are there questions that you particularly need to treat carefully, and how would you treat them? I mean, I think, as we said yesterday, I think, or the day before, probably the biggest one are questions about sexuality in Western culture. They're probably ones that would have the most kind of riding on them. Second to that, probably questions about other religions, because again, that's this, is this idea of you're rejecting people for who they are, either for their sexuality or for their religious beliefs or so on. Anything that makes you sound like you're being racist or you know, having a particular issue with people. So I think we need to be really careful in those situations. As I said yesterday, questions about sexuality, if it comes up in a Q&A and I've not just given a talk on the subjects, I would probably veer away from trying to say too much. And I would just say, look, this is a really big issue. I would maybe say some general principles. You know, the Bible says sex is a really good thing. God created it. It's for our enjoyment. The Bible also gives us a blueprint on sexuality. That shouldn't be a surprise to us if we believe that there might be a God who created sex in the first place. If there's no God, it doesn't matter what you do with sex. It's just another physical thing. But if there is a God, maybe he has got something to say on it. But we'll never really understand the context of what he's saying unless we see the bigger picture of what it means to really understand who this God is and so on. And so I won't get drawn into then like giving specific, you know, this is what I agree with or don't in that public context, because I know that maybe that would be unhelpful. I remember once, just give you one final illustration. I was doing a talk in Bristol University. Someone put their hand up and they said, are you saying that you think that the Quran is not from God? And you can see everyone kind of, you know, big sharp intake of breath, you know, what is he going to say? I mean, you know, it's the most politically incorrect thing you could say is to say someone's wrong, right? And so, big intake of breath, everyone looked around and prayed quickly, and they just said, well, of course I am. Because if I thought it was from God, I'd be a Muslim, wouldn't I? And then everyone kind of laughed, and people realised the kind of absurdity of it. And sometimes, just to be able to kind of, you know, the questions are given so much kind of weight, and actually just to be able to think of something a bit lighter to say in response can lift the kind of atmosphere and say, and actually the reality is, you know, most of the people in the room didn't believe the Quran was from God either. But it's just that in our culture, you can't say things like that. So sometimes to avoid it, or sometimes just to tackle it head on, and say, well, I know this is, you know, not politically correct, but I think the main thing is to pray for some wisdom from God in the context, and I can't say there's a definite thing I'd say every time.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.